It is my pleasure to introduce the leader of the Ulster Unionist Party, Mike Nesbitt, MLA.
Started yet? Well, good afternoon, conference. Are we in good heart?
Yes.
But you said that last year. Are you saying we're in better heart this year?
Yes.
All right. Wouldn't be anything to do with a little election last May, would it?
Yes.
Well, you know what? We did okay. And of course, it was my first leading the party, and I want to thank you, conference, for giving me that privilege. I've got to tell you, I quite enjoyed it. And what I really enjoyed was making 88 phone calls. Phoning 88 people who had the bravery to stand up for us, put themselves in the front line, and start each of those 88 conversations with, "Congratulations, Super Councillor." That conference, and sitting with this man, our MEP Jim Nicholson, up at Balmoral on the Monday, when the inevitable result came through, and Jim was sent back to Brussels as one of the most experienced, respected, and influential members of the European Parliament, Jim Nicholson. Isn't it great? When was the last time we came to conference with something to celebrate? It's great, isn't it? But there was a downside. The phone calls that I didn't want to make to friends like Olive Mercer, Joy Rolston, Walter Lyons and the rest, to say, "I'm sorry you did not make it." And the reason they didn't make it is because they played as team players. They stuck to the plan, they tried to get two in, and it didn't quite work out. And conference, on your behalf, I thank them for being team players for the Ulster Unionist Party. You can describe us now in a lot of ways. You can say we are stable. You can say we're showing discipline, if you like. The bottom line is, we are a team now. We're playing as a team, and we are seeing the rewards at the elections. And there's one other value and characteristic we're demonstrating, which I think is the most important of all today. We're hungry. We're hungry for more, and we want to get to Westminster 2015. I'll say a bit more about the next elections in a moment, but first I want to say a few words about the past, the present, and then the future. Now, conference, the past is on the agenda for these new talks, and I don't think the status quo is sustainable, so I'm happy that we go in positively to try and do better, particularly by victims. But you know, during the Haas talks, there was not one party, not even Sinn Féin, thought you could get to the whole truth about the Troubles. And what I can't figure out is, what part of the truth will we not get to? Is it the most shameful, the most incriminating, the most embarrassing? We need to find out what truths we will get to and which truths we will not get to, because it is important for the individual victims. And I want to illustrate that with a true life story that I came across in the Victims Commission. And I just warn you, it doesn't end well. A man stoops to kiss his wife goodbye. He has to bend because she's on the carpet with their baby who is teething, and looking back, she says she didn't pay him due attention. But then again, it wasn't as if he was going away. He was just going out to do a night shift around the corner. But as it turns out, it was the last time she ever saw him alive, shot dead by so-called loyalists. Come forward over 30 years, she has remarried. She's a grandmother by both sets. She's moved a long way from where she used to live. And she answers a phone call from a man representing the historical inquiries team. She says, "I've never heard of you," so he has to explain. "We're a division of the police. Our job is to go through every case file of every trouble-related murder." She says, "I'm not interested," and moved on. And she's horrified, horrified when he says, "I'm sorry, you can't stop us. It is our statutory duty. I'm just wondering, are there any questions that have been lingering that you'd like us to try and tackle?" She said, "I'm not interested in you. Go away." 6-7 months pass. They phone again. Courtesy call this time. "Just to let you know, we have completed the report. And we're just making doubly sure there isn't anybody you would like to read it." Human nature being what it is, curiosity got the better of her. She read it. And as she'd believed for over 30 years he went to work, as she'd believed for all that time, a car pulled up and a man in a balaclava got out of the back seat. As she'd believed for over 30 years he walked up to her husband, produced a gun, shot him. Bang, 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 4 times in the chest. Her one crumb of comfort was that for over 30 years she believed he was dead before he hit the tarmac. She read, "He lay bleeding to death for 20 minutes, screaming her name." Conference. Sometimes there are truths about our past that some people simply do not need to know. So, as we enter fresh talks that include dealing with the past, I hope we do what the Haas process failed to do, which is to answer 3 key questions. Number 1, can we agree a common definition of what we mean by dealing with the past? 2, if we can, then for whose benefit do we want to deal with the past? Is it for victims and survivors, incident by incident? Or is it to enable society to move on? Because these are not necessarily parallel tracks, as became clear through the anger of victims when the Attorney General suggested that we draw a line and simply move on. Conference, I do not support an amnesty, because even though there is little prospect of more convictions at this stage, it does happen occasionally. RUC officer John Proctor's widow saw a murderer convicted of that offence last year, 32 years after the event. It is rare, yes, and victims know it's rare. But there's the world of difference between allowing them to cling to a little hope and a government cruelly extinguishing that hope altogether. And the third question is this: do we want to deal with the past or with its legacy? Because we cannot change what happened in the past, but we can tackle the legacy. The legacy is toxic. It infiltrates every aspect of our lives. And one of the biggest poisons, as I told you last year at conference, is our massive problem with poor mental health and well-being. We have far too many citizens who wake up in the morning with no sense of purpose in their lives, who go to bed at night without a sense of having achieved something. And we can change that. We can change it by committing to tackle poor mental health and well-being, not just in individuals and families, but above all, in communities. We can tackle it, we can tackle educational underachievement, we can improve areas of multiple deprivation. Frankly, we can turn the past into a means of creating a better future. Last week, I had lunch with the mayor of Ards and Daisy's Cafe on the community hospital campus down in Ards. It's a social enterprise that's run for the benefit of people with learning difficulties and mental health issues. It's been there for about 15 years, and in that time, no fewer than 65 people with mental problems have trained there and are now working in catering jobs in the private sector. They're waking up with a sense of purpose. They're going to bed with a sense of achievement. So we can and we are transforming our society. We can transform communities. We can transform lives for the better. And the social economy has a huge role to play. And with the pressure on public finances today, I say to the representatives of the third sector in this room, your time has come. Your problem, I guess, is that too many politicians don't get areas of life like the social economy because they're obsessed with the old-fashioned binary approach to everything that we do. In economics, it has to be private sector or public sector. Politics has to be orange or green. It has to be win or lose. Conference, no, it doesn't. No, it does not. Life is three-dimensional. Embrace the challenge. Embrace the beauty of the complexity. So if the past is to be on the agenda for the talks, and it is, we have already made clear that there is a simple choice. We can get stuck in the mud of another fruitless round of endless arguing over competing narratives, or we can collectively commit to tackle the legacy of the past in a way that transforms the well-being and the prosperity of our people. Is that conference not a fairer way to do business? Richard Haass proposed a series of expensive new legacy bodies, and he did so with a focus on a human rights approach. It's an approach that did not consider what we can afford. A human rights approach must be tempered by a resource approach, because our resources are not infinite, and we have to stop failing victims by building up their expectations only to dash them because we cannot deliver for them. Today, the HET is gone, the police ombudsman is knocking doors to tell families, remember I promised you an investigation? Well, I'm sorry, I no longer have the resources to deliver. Do you know the office of the First Minister and Deputy First Minister ran a process in March encouraging victims and survivors to approach the new victim service? 3,700 first-timers knocked on the door of the VSS as a result, and since then, 3,700 people have been told, I am sorry, but the cupboard is bare. Conference, that's obscene. Obscene. We can do better, we should do better, and under Ulster Unionist leadership, we will do better. I'm hearing other parties warming up for the talks by lecturing us on what we need to do. Martin McGuinness calls me disappointing and irresponsible, and the others are saying similar things. I shall not, conference, respond in kind. I think people are bored with that sort of politics. They're bored with traditional sectarian politics on which other parties seem to thrive. They're bored with that old binary approach, black, white, orange, green, right, wrong. It's tit for tat. I think... I think people are eager for something a bit more imaginative, something that maybe even reflects their own lives as they live them in multiple dimensions. Within a five-mile radius of here, you'll find Muslims who call themselves British, Muslims who call themselves Irish. You might even find the occasional Irish unionist. Remember, Sir Edward Carson was a Dublin-born unionist. And one more example, conference. We, as unionists, tend to look with a fairly jaundiced eye on the influence that the United States brings to bear on our affairs. Perhaps not a surprise, given Gerry Adams has been lobbying the USA for 20 years, John Hume was doing it 20 years before him. So what have we done? Well, we have to think about what we really have done and remind America that when they needed a constitution, the Ulster Scots helped them write it, helped them print it, and designed the eagle that flies above it. When they needed to defend Texas, we sent them Davy Crockett. When they needed a bank to fire their industrial revolution, we sent them the Mellon family. When they needed a great president, we sent them several. Andrew Jackson, Ulysses S. Grant, and Theodore Roosevelt, and a dozen more. And of course, when they wanted to land a man on the moon, we sent them Neil Armstrong. I think it is time to awaken the power of the Ulster Scots influence in America and use it for our advantage. Yes, we have some catching up to do, conference, but I promise you, we have begun. It is also time to stop negativity being the political default position. Since I was elected, I have been astonished at how easy it is to be negative, how much energy you put into it, and how much more challenging it is to actually be positive. So my message today is not for the other parties entering the talks. My message is for us, the past and future leaders of unionism. My message is positive, and it's for unionists, hard and soft. It's okay to love the union. In fact, it's good for you. It's good for everybody. And the arguments are made. Just ask the people of Scotland. The Scottish independence debate should make us think deep about our politics, because for decades, policymakers in London and Dublin have peddled a snake oil at us, a sort of geopolitical snake oil. It's called the Irish dimension. At its core is a myth. It's the myth that because Ireland is an island, a united Ireland is inevitable. But conference, geography is not destiny. Geography does not determine political outcomes. Yes, geography says Ireland is an island. But no, it does not say that the whole island has to be one state. Anymore, the geography says the Iberian Peninsula should be a single political identity, so Portugal and Spain have to somehow merge. Geography does not and will not dictate our destiny. We will do that for ourselves. I want our people to prosper. And if we're to do that, we need to refocus on economic growth. For 2 years now, we have been stuck in a debate on welfare reform, not prosperity. So let me deal with welfare reform first. Does the Ulster Unionist Party believe in a compassionate state that looks after its vulnerable? Yes, we do. Of course we do. It's one of the values that makes the kingdom great. Although I have to say, as a society, we too often fall short. We fail victims and survivors of the Troubles. We fail victims of child sex abuse, like at Kinkora. We fail our armed forces and our veterans. But yes, this party does support and it values the concept of a welfare state. Is the welfare state as good as it can be and as fair as it can be? No, it's not. As all our elected representatives know only too well, huge numbers of our citizens do not claim their full entitlements. And that's because the system is so very complicated. There are too many benefits with far, far too many hurdles for vulnerable people to jump through before they can qualify. So, this party is clear. Bring welfare reform to the floor of the Assembly. We're waiting. We have our amendments. Everybody knows what we're going to change. We'll make it fairer. We'll shape it to the best fit for the needs of our people. Is that not the whole point of devolution? The debate over whether or not there should be welfare reform is over. That happened at Westminster. It's high time the Assembly had the debate on what we're going to do differently from Westminster and then move on. Move on to debate how we can become better corporate citizens of the United Kingdom, citizens who don't continuously keep running to London for another economic handout. Last week, the SDLP, the Sinn Féin DUP coalition, surrendered control of our affairs to Mr. George Osborne's pawn shop. Be in no doubt, conference. The local finance minister isn't Simon Hamilton anymore. It's the Chancellor, George Osborne. And the DUP accused us of a pact with the Tories. The executive has to agree the 2015-16 budget by the end of this month, but not with the Assembly. No, it has to be done with Treasury. And not because it makes good financial sense to rush it through, but because George Osborne is now pulling the strings because of a quite ludicrous £100 million loan. The terms and conditions of the Chancellor's loan are quite explicit in his letter. The DUP and Sinn Féin have signed up to the welfare reform penalties of £87 million this year and £114 million next year. It's in the letter. It's one of the terms and conditions. So, yes, we're £100 million better off this year, but next year we're £301 million worse off. It makes a Wonga pay deal look pretty damned generous. Conference, the first issue that these new talks must address is the budget. If we cannot balance our books, there's nothing more to discuss. So let us do it. But let us do it with good grace. I want unionists to be positive and progressive. Unionists who are reconnected with their work ethic. Unionists rediscovering how the world admired our abilities in service and sacrifice, in dedication and determination, in innovation and in the inclusion of others. These are values that are endless and endlessly positive. I stand for a Northern Ireland that starts generating serious wealth for its citizens. Now, they say money can't buy you happiness, but far too many of our citizens are neither wealthy nor happy, and I want people to have the opportunity to experience both. And talking of service, and talking of sacrifice, I want to acknowledge two real Yes We Can characters who are new to the party since our conference last year. The first is Captain Doug Beattie, MC, one of our many newly elected representatives who came through in last May's local government elections conference. Please welcome Councillor Doug Beattie, MC. And the other, of course, Andy Allen. Welcome to the Ulster Unionist Party. Andy, you chose to serve your country by joining the army. You put yourself in harm's way to defend this country's values, and you got badly hurt. I want you to know that I am humbled that you've decided to join the Ulster Unionist Party on my watch. And I'm delighted you've decided that your next phase of public service is through political engagement. In the health debate, Andy challenged us, support the military covenant. And you know, the military covenant is more than just some sort of agreement to ensure our military personnel and veterans have proper access to services, and that is very, very important. But it is also a recognition that we, as a nation, have a moral obligation to members of the armed forces and their families. And those aren't my words. Those are the words of the Prime Minister, a moral obligation. So is there any good reason why that obligation is not explicitly honoured here in Northern Ireland? I don't think so. So, Andy, my response to you is this. Every Ulster Unionist candidate going forward in next year's general election will make a pledge in advance that if elected, they will bring forward as soon as they possibly can at Westminster a private member's bill to introduce the military covenant to Northern Ireland. Andy Allen, Doug Beattie, we're listening. Candidates, just make it happen. And in response, Andy, a little challenge for you. I want you at Stormont as an MLA. I want you there, Andy, as an inspiration and a role model for people with disabilities. As a man with public service in your DNA, Now, you may not be able to fight fights on foreign fields anymore, but you can fight for your colleagues in the Assembly Chamber and the committee rooms of Stormont. Please accept the challenge, Andy Allen. You know, I believe on the eve of battle with Napoleon, the Duke of Wellington famously said at one time, "I don't know what effect these troops have upon the enemy, but by God, they frighten me." I'm not talking about Andy and Doug. I'm talking about our new health team, Joanne Dobson and Michael McGimsey, Jim Wells. Be afraid. Be very, very afraid. This team's going to be hard to beat. And let me pay tribute to them and to all our spokespeople, and also our minister, Danny Kennedy, not least for his cycling revolution. I encourage you, conference, do not underestimate Minister Kennedy. I've sat at his side many times in the last couple of years at negotiations. I suspect the Duke of Wellington would have developed a nervous tic if he had had to sit in Danny's company for too long. A final reflection today, about today, before I focus on the future. We have been blighted with sectarianism for decades now. We've now got the added problem of race hate. Now, given how the Polish nation stood shoulder to shoulder with us in the Second World War, it is beyond obscene that members of our Polish community, as with any other ethnic minority, are being subjected to hate crime. It is simply a perversion of our shared past. Now, we're in the early stages of this conference, but I want your support to secure a memorial to the Polish who lost their lives in the war and are buried here in Northern Ireland. This party wishes to show respect to our Polish community and indeed all our ethnic minorities. As to the future, I see good things for this party and great potential, at least for Northern Ireland. The key is changing the way we do politics. We need an official opposition at Stormont more than ever before, and these talks finally present the opportunity to make the case in a formal setting, and we have already begun that process. We also need a shift from silo mentality government, where departments don't work together, and the fix, conference, is easy. After the next Assembly election, agree the programme for government before you divide up the ministries. Now, yes, we did propose that in 2011 without success, but I've got to tell you, in the corridors of power at Stormont, the logic of the argument is gaining critical support. And the third big change we want at Stormont is a return to the joint ticket election of the offices of the First Minister and Deputy First Minister. That's what the people agreed in the 1998 referendum. The DUP and Sinn Féin carved up government at St Andrews, and we're sick, and the people are sick, of being told to vote for fear. The DUP go canvassing, their message, vote for us or something bad's going to happen to you. We say let's move on. We say to the electorate from now on, vote for what you hope for. These issues are on the Secretary of State's table for the forthcoming talks. On our table is a simple test. Are we doing what's right for Northern Ireland? So, conference, I want us to build on our stability, our discipline, our teamwork. I want us to build on our successes last May and focus on our next key electoral goal, the Ulster Unionist Party back in the House of Commons. And for those who think we always select our candidates far too late into the cycle, can I ask you, conference, to please formally acknowledge our Westminster candidates for May next year, here in the middle of October, already selected, ratified and endorsed, candidates for Upper Ban and for South Antrim, Joanne Dobson and Danny Kinahan. Up, 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 up. And we're on course to have all our candidates in place by the end of the calendar year. And of course, if you're wondering about understandings with other parties, let me say this. The DUP lost East Belfast last time out, and there is a real danger they could lose North Belfast next time. And what would that mean? That means Belfast could be left without a single unionist representative. The capital city of this great country without a single unionist representative in the House of Commons. That is simply not acceptable. And it's a danger that should galvanise unionism. It's a prospect that should and has activated our commitment to doing what's right for Northern Ireland, which sits above doing what's right for us. So the Ulster Unionist Party is prepared to support the DUP in North Belfast because it is the right thing to do for unionism and for Northern Ireland. But in return, conference, we expect them to support us in trying to return the most westerly constituency in the whole of the United Kingdom to unionist control. We want Fermanagh South Tyrone. We had a mighty result last May in Fermanagh South Tyrone, and I tell you, the DUP and anybody who wants to listen, we can win the Westminster seat for Fermanagh South Tyrone. Conference, the Secretary of State will be with us right after lunch, and I hope you'll come and listen to what she has to say. She chairs these very important talks going forward. And over lunch, we have a session on attracting more women into public life. That's a huge, huge issue, and I thank Raid McGuinness for joining us to lead that debate. I'm not sure. I think my wife has a prior commitment. Don't know. Not sure at all. But conference in closing. Keep your eye on the journey, because we are on a journey. It's a two electoral cycle for me. And the end of that two electoral cycle will be the Assembly elections, which are currently scheduled for 2021. 2021, the centenary of the foundation of the country. Where do I want us to be in 2021? Where we were in 1921.